But you know, I suppose that the most difficult job that you will face when you start offering services inside the church building, you know, when everybody comes into the church for the Christian education programs, I have an idea that the biggest problem that you will face to deal with is attitude. And we like to sort of brush that off and say, well, if we are Christians, we ought to have the right kind of attitude. And if we see it that way, I'm afraid that we won't really come to grips with the problem. And we really need to deal with some of those negative attitudes. I think one of the things that we have got to recognize is that inside our heads, we all have negative attitudes about things. Right? All right, now then, if we know that to be so, I don't think we ought to come down too hard on people who are having any other kinds of negative attitudes. We just might have been spared from that particular one for a time. You know, we just might be not having to deal with that one. But how do you go about changing attitude? How do you take a very negative attitude and turn that into a very positive kind of an attitude? Especially when we are dealing with things that have probably been in our heads all of our lives. We have been taught, believe it or not, the way we feel about most things by our parents. Most of the ideas that I had and the concepts that I have in my head in some way were put into me by my mother and my father. Those things were passed down to me. Now, one of the kinds of things that I will always be grateful that they did not pass down to me was that there were different kinds of people in the world. I want to tell something to you that I was so grateful to my parents when this happened. When I was doing my training a year ago, when I was doing my training, I had to work with persons who had cleft palates. That was the part that I had to do. And that bothered me. I did not have the right kind of attitude toward persons who had, through no fault of their own, been born with cleft palates, and it was my responsibility to teach them how to talk. So I went to my supervisor, and I said, I do want to discuss my feelings with you about the way I think about cleft palate persons. I said, I just don't want to do that. And I'll do anything else that you want me to do. I'll do double the work, but just don't make me do that. Well, I thought he had communicated with me beautifully, and I went off for a time of rest from my studies and came back and got my assignments out of my box, and there on that list was, are you ready? 12 cleft palate persons to work with. I went to him and I said, I don't think you understood me. I don't want to do that. And he said, you cannot be a professional person and maintain that attitude. You work with these people. Oh, the first month, I was ready to die. When it was all over, he came to me the second session of that, when they had changed some of my cases. And he said, now, you need to let me know how many cleft palate persons you are working with. And he was ready for the information because he had to fill out a report for the government. And he was waiting for me to get that. And I said, I don't know. And he said, what do you mean to tell me you don't know? He said, of all people who said that you were just so bothered by that, here, 2 or 3 months later, you say you don't even know how many cleft palates. And I said, well, if I can say the names, will you know the diagnosis? And he got the most beautiful smile on his face. Now, he said, you've changed your attitude. And you know what changed my attitude? Being with the people. And all of a sudden, what it is that is wrong is not the real issue. And when I looked at all of those, and most of these were just little children, when I look back on that experience, and I see those youngsters on the streets of Knoxville, Tennessee, and they say hi to me and good morning to me, that just gives me the best kind of a feeling that these are little people that I gave a little bit of help to learn to cope with life. But let me tell you the other side of it. When I see those youngsters that I struggled with for that month, wondering, oh, will I ever get through this? Do you see what they gave me? They gave me a totally positive attitude toward them. So you see, that kind of shift is one of the things that is going to have to come about in our attitudes. I cannot maintain a good attitude as long as I am standoffish from the situation. You know, I can't, you know, I just can't sit around in my lounge room. Notice that didn't say living room, I'm sitting around in my lounge room, I can't sit around and think about what my attitude is and do anything about changing it, you know. And after a while, and I think this is so important to do, you have got to have a happy blending of everything being natural and neutral, but with a keen awareness of what the individual needs are. Did I get that said right? You can't totally eliminate all of those kinds of feelings, but when you respond to the person, you respond to the person and not the problem, and that's the key to it. And when you're able to do that, then you're well on your way to switching the kind of a negative attitude that you might have on the inside. Now, there is another thing that I want to suggest, and when I look at the size of this room and I remember the number of persons that I have talked to, some of this part will be a repetition to you, but I really want to stress this. I think we all ought to think that we are not perfect. Now, do you have friends who say, well, I am not perfect, but now what they mean is they are, you know? You know, I don't want to leave the impression that I'm perfect. And down on the inside, they are thinking, you know, I've got this all together and this guy's the one that's wrong. But that is the truth. Every one of us in this room work with some disability. Now, let me sort of switch that around. Every one of us in this room have a problem that we have to deal with on a day-in and day-out basis. That's something. You know, I don't know what everybody's problem is. But everybody in this room, not just every day, but this morning, while we're sitting here at 20 past 11, we are dealing with a problem of some sort. Okay? Now, I want you to think about that. Just get that in your head. Right there. Now, I want you to reduce that, whatever that problem is, to one word. Do that for me. Now, that's as far as we'll go with it. But what if I would say to you, now, write that problem down on a card. Now, write it big and bold. Now, we want to be sure we can read it. Don't scribble it. Just print it. I think everybody would do that for me. But then there would be some reluctance if I would dare to suggest, now let's pin them on us. And during the lunch hour, we will discuss each other's problems. Now you see, just very quickly, what happens is, when I walk up to Gordon Young, whom I have learned to love and appreciate since I have been in Australia, and I look down, and Gordon to me is a, you know, friendly, outgoing, caring kind of a person. And I look at him and say, oh, I see his problem. You see? Now, immediately, I began to respond to what it is that's coming out of him, and I do not respond to him as a person. And you see what that does to the communication chain that's going on between us? It becomes very uncomfortable and very uneasy with me because that's what I am responding to. I'm not responding to him. And we all want to be responded. Now, you see how that changes attitude? When we just take the time to recognize that all of us are, in fact, not perfect. Now, let that one go through. So that, you know, when I see a tad of imperfection, I can accept that. But you know something? And now this is the next thing I'll say about attitude changing. Why is it that us human folks are so bad to walk up to a person who has 100 qualities? 99 of them are good. One of them is bad. And then we go away and we talk about the one that is bad. And very soon it gets to be that that is all that we discuss. I will always remember this, much to my chagrin. I have a very good friend who sort of reminds me of Lynette, and I think, among other things, that was one of the reasons that I just sort of liked her from the beginning. And she also has to use a wheelchair from time to time to get about. And she was going to go on a visit, and she was going to be close to some friends of mine. And I said to my friend, now, whatever you do, look them up. They'd be delighted to see you. So I called my friends and described this person. I said, you just really need to meet her. You'll love her. You'll think she's great. You just need to visit with her. And she's going to be there for some time, and be sure you go over to see her. Well, the friend called me later, and he said, Jim Pearson, don't you ever do that to us again. Said, we had her in our house. And he said, why didn't you tell us the most obvious thing? And I said, what did I forget? He said that she's in a wheelchair. And I said, oh. You know, and what they had done was to have her room ready on the second floor of the house and all those kinds of things, you know. And I said, well, how did you handle that? And he said, as fast as we've ever handled anything in our life. You know, but you see, and Christians, I just can't say that enough. I think that it's a scriptural concept. If we see our brothers and sisters overtaken in faults, to go up and say, now, you know, I think if you continue to do that, that might be wrong. You know, that kind of easy thing. But this business of always picking apart people will never help us change our attitudes. You know, when we get into that kind of a real, I'm going to see the best in you. And when I see the best in you, then that sort of eliminates all those things that we might say are not the most positive things to deal with. Now, I'm not Pollyanna, but I'll tell you what, I go to bed sleeping better at night because of that attitude than I do if I sit around and figure out what's wrong with everybody around me, you see. And I think as we develop into that kind of thing, sort of there's a blending of things. That, you know, people become people and not problems, and their problems sort of fade away, and we become like them. You see what I'm after? Now, let me tell you another thing I think will change attitudes. It's to really recognize that we need help. Do you feel needy? Do you feel self-sufficient? You think you got it all together? No. No. It's just not that way at all. It's as a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. There is never a time in our lives that we don't stand in sort of a needy kind of a posture. Now, I'm not too sure when this first hit me in the head. We have misused a passage of Scripture. We have used it too much on the doors that take care of children who do not have mothers and daddies, too much on the doors of agencies that serve variously disabled persons, unto the least of these. And we leave the impression by that attitude that everybody that's there, that's being helped, is the least of these, and all of us, biggest of these, is doing some help. It doesn't work that way. All of us are the least of these. At some time, we're all going to be in that position. And when we recognize that, that just sort of starts that attitude change that really needs to come about in order for us to render an open attitude toward variously people with all sorts of problems. What am I saying? I am saying that it's an individual matter that has to start with us. And I want to make everybody evangelists immediately. If you believe that concept, don't keep it to yourself. Practice it. But whatever you do, sit down and chat with people about that. And I think that will affect the greatest attitude kinds of changes ever. When we realize from our own vantage point that we are first and foremost people, that we all have problems, that we're all the least of these, and then when we deal and work with persons, then it makes it a lot easier for us to really give who we are to them. Okay? Now, the quickest way to change an attitude is to change your heart. And if I don't sound overly preachy, I think it would not be appropriate in a Christian meeting for me not to say, going to God in private and saying, Lord, create in me a clean spirit. Does that get an attitude? Restore in me a good attitude toward people. Give that to me. Help me to forgive the people that despitefully use me. You see? And when I get those kinds of prayers going, and God answers those prayers through me, that helps my attitudes to switch. Okay, now, that's all I want to say about that. And then I want to break very quickly into sort of a practical thing of how do we get started in this program? How do we build a philosophy of dealing with intellectual handicapped persons in the church? Now, the first one that I want to say to you is that I think we have got to maintain a concept that we're going to go get them. Does that sound too fast? Yes. You know, we're not just going to build a program and say, we're going to send out an announcement about what our beautiful program is, and then everybody's going to come in, because, see, most of the people that we're talking about aren't going to be able to read it to start with. So we're going to have to do the New Testament concept of going into the highways and the hedges and compelling them to come in. You know, we've got the banquet ready, and now we need the guests. And we're not going to rely on the standard kinds of guests that have everything going for them. We're going to get a different sort of a population into us. We're going to ask all that list of things, persons who are physically handicapped, persons who are intellectually handicapped. We're going to ask all those people to come in. But let's talk about an intellectual handicap, because that's what I'm talking about. We're going to go out and find it. We're going to go to the agencies that serve them and say, let these people know that we have the problem, that we have the program. We're going to go into the community and say, we want to be of service. You know, and when we do that, we then go into the highways and hedges and compel them to come in. And that kind of thing keeps us from saying this age-old one is that, well, we don't have any. You know, we would really like to start a program, but we don't have any. Well, I doubt that's the truth. Because if the population numbers are right, they're going to be there. And the thing that keeps us from knowing where they are is that we have never sought them out. We have never really worked. You know, I don't know very many ideas that really work just by making an announcement and everybody comes. You have to work at it a little bit. You know, you have to do a little bit of behind-the-scenes work to get that accomplished. So hard work is one of those things that is really essential by going into the community and compelling persons to come in to where we are. Now, there's something else, and if this is the next one, I used to say numbers, but my students always smile at me about my numbers because I'll have 6 8s and 2 4s and no ones and that kind of stuff. And I think it's so very important that in that compelling people to come in, that the congregation be prepared for what it is that's going to happen. I'm glad everybody, many people wrote that one down. Congregation needs to be ready. Congregation needs to understand what it is that's going to happen. But now I want to finish my sentence. And the persons who are going to be coming in anew also need to be prepared. You know, we need to know what it is that's going to happen. The congregation needs to be told what is the nature of the service that we're going to render. They need to be told things like we've talked about this morning, that it is a two-way kind of a situation, that while we give, we also receive. We have a lady who comes to our church on Sunday morning. When she is not there, I have an idea that if I'm not there, nobody really misses me. But everybody wants to know when this lady who comes to our special class, where is she? Do you know why they miss her? As she walks through the lobby of the church, she speaks to everybody. She wants to know how everybody is. And the other Sunday morning, just before I left, 2 Sundays before, a prayer request had been made in the public, in the sanctuary, and she asked this person how things were going. You know what embarrassed me about that? I'd forgotten about the prayer request. She remembered that. She was concerned about that. And that kind of a thing the congregation really needs to know. Now, that we're not coming in here just to do something. We're going to come in here to have things done together. The preacher can do a lot to help that. Preach a few sermons, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You can have persons like you who are interested to come up and say what it means to you. You can have families come in and talk about what having the church programs available to everybody, how beneficial that is. And then after the right kind of time for that happening, then you're sort of ready to open up and say, all right, we're ready to begin our program. We're ready to do what we need to do. Now, on the other side of that, we need to be sure that the persons who are coming in anew understand that there might be some little problems, you know, that everybody will not be just open and accepting, but give it time. Give it time. Let everybody know. Give it time. Give it time. And then if from the front end we have handled it that way, when everybody comes together, then that's going to be a mutual kind of a working out. The worst thing that I've ever seen happen is that when nobody was prepared, everybody was just thrown in together and nobody really understood. We had about 15 children who were brought to our church one Sunday from a group home serving teenage youngsters. And there was not time to prepare. And we found many children in that group, after we worked with them, who had never in their lives been in a church. They didn't even know what it was. They didn't know how to act. They didn't know what what the offering plate was. They didn't know what the Lord's Supper was. They didn't know anything. They didn't know why somebody stood up and did that with their hands when they started the songs to sing. And they didn't know why there was one lady playing something on that side and somebody, you know, it was just all a big excitement to them. And we took the time to explain that, and that makes that mutual. You see what I'm trying to talk about? You just cannot get that done just by saying, all right, we're going to do it, and we ought to do it, it's been a long time coming, but that's just an essential thing to do. All right, now, I'll talk to you about something else that I think is so important. When we get them into the congregation, I think it becomes increasingly important that we think through our theology about that. Do you know a lot of parents of handicapped children have been left the wrong impression by the church? That they did something wrong. And I've just had a parent of a handicapped child to shake her head. Yes. That it's a moral issue we're facing. Oh. And I have read chapters on theology. You know. But there is no theology that gets me past this one. Jesus had that one put to him. Dealing with a person who had a problem. Somebody wanted to know who'd caused that. Is the sin in the man or is it in his mother and father? And Jesus said, it's in him. It's all his fault. No, he said it's all in his mother and father. It's a sin they're heaping. No, he said. Now, I'd like to know how he looked on his face when he said, neither. I don't think it was a pleasant reply. I think Jesus said, neither of those answers are right. This thing has happened that the glory of God might be revealed. As you say here, that's a Butte theology. That removes guilt. That removes blame. And that says to the church, minister to those persons recognizing that these kinds of things happen, that the glory of God be revealed. You know Helen Keller. What would have happened to Helen Keller if she had felt guilty about her problem? The world would never have known the beauty of that personality. Isn't that marvelous? Now, that's just the way we ought to think about it. And that is the kind of theology that we really, really ought to be talking about when we talk about in the church serving handicapped persons. And that comes up with a foundation of a philosophy that we really ought to be dealing with and not one of these mid-16th century kinds of concepts that none of us know how to deal with except for the fact that it's just sort of passed down from one person to the other and we never really get into dealing with what the real issue is, and that is that it's a matter of genetics. One of the most beautiful speeches I've ever heard was made by the superintendent of a facility that when he was making the speech was a huge place. He's a medical doctor, marvelous human being, and he went around making speeches on the theology of handicapped persons. That's what he did all the time. And it wasn't his speech that made the difference. But when that person who had cerebral palsy walked into the front of a group, and he said, with his cerebral palsy hand holding up. Ladies and gentlemen, when we recognize that we are dealing with genetics and not God, all of our problems will be made easier. He didn't need to say anything else. And for us to heap guilt and anguish and pain on people is more than the church ought to be doing. We ought to be relieving, not adding to those hurts and those problems and those things. All right. Now, while we're talking about that theology, I want to tell you something else we ought to start doing. We ought to start preaching right. We say that Jesus is the example. That the best example for us. How many sermons do you hear on Jesus' interaction with people who had various problems? Very many. Have you heard one recently? Does that mean that Jesus never did face persons who had problems? No. Because what we have done is to symbolize away the stories of Jesus' interactions with persons who were blind, who were hard of hearing, who were crippled, who were epileptic, who were all those kinds of problems. Do you remember when Jesus healed the blind man and it wasn't quite complete and Jesus sort of did it again and the man said, "I see trees moving"? You know, Jesus knew right away that there's a little bit more that needed to be done. Now, the beauty of that story needs to be told. It needs to be preached from the pulpit. Now, I want to tell you that at this point, I'm going to pass on by saying that in the morning, I'm going to practice what I preach. When we go to church tomorrow morning, I want to talk about one of those beautiful stories and just let the truths of that roll out. Not going to be symbolic. I'm just going to say what it was that Jesus did. And when we convey that kind of thing into the church, what Jesus' real attitude was, what his ministry was, we're going to make a whole lot of difference. I had a person to say to me after I'd made that point one time, "But we can't heal." You know what I said? "Yes, we can too." Oh, no. Mm-hmm. Because I'll tell you one thing. All healing is not physical. Yes. The healing takes place inside. You see. So I think we need to do that. All right, now let me tell you something else, and this is a little bit fussy. Not fussy. The preacher, the minister, the pastor, the reverend, whatever we're going to call him, needs to be the chief spokesman of the new service. Is that okay? Needs to be behind it. Now let me tell you the reason I feel that way so much. When people come through the door of my agency, they frequently say it's a friendly, happy place. It's a warm, friendly place, they say to me. Do you know why that's so? I insist on it. Now, you know, I don't get up and have staff meetings every morning saying, "Everybody's going to be happy today." You know, it's not that kind of thing. Do you know how I get that accomplished? I am friendly and happy with my staff people. And when I am friendly and happy with my staff people, they share that attitude with somebody else. They sort of see that is the standard that's going to be abided by today, and that's what we do. You know, that's what we act on. If you walk into a store to buy something and somebody's sort of not nice to you, you know what I would bet quickly? Is that the head man sort of conveyed that attitude. And if the minister is not really sold on the program, I think we need to spend a week or two to get him sold on the program so his attitude will come over. You know, and I think that all of us, if we opened up and we don't want to pick out the one bad problem in people, we've already talked about that a little bit, but if we talked about ministerial attitudes, you would come up with some negative kinds of things that people have experienced, that you have been told about, that actually happened. So I think that's important. All right, now, next thing I want to talk about are the kinds of programs that need to be available to these persons in the church. At this minute, I want to move. It's on. Great. All right. Now, the first program that I want to mention is an honest-to-goodness Christian education program for intellectually handicapped persons operated inside the church. It's done in the church building. It is done by church people for the persons in the community. Now, I get a lot of questions asked about that. What do we need to do in that program? Exactly the same thing that you do in your regular programs if you do them right. Okay? And that is to do a step-by-step teaching of the wonderful messages of Jesus Christ. Not haphazard. Not one of these little things that you do and say, all right, now today we're going to do a lesson on Psalms. You know, we're going to read a psalm and say a lesson about that. And then the next Sunday, we're going to do one on Abraham. We're going to do a story about Abraham. And then the Sunday after that, we're going to do one of Jesus' miracles and that kind of thing. Now, that kind of teaching is not what I'm talking about. When we take the person, our persons, from, if you will, square one and move all the way up until we have systematically led them to a point of being able to accept Jesus Christ, then we are talking about the kind of a teaching program, a Christian education program, that we want to get started. We don't want something just to fill up time. But now, will you let me say something parenthetically? All of us, I'm gathering in the main, have been in church a good deal of our lives. We've gone to a lot of church services. Have you ever been to a church service that you really felt most of the purpose of it was to fill up the time? You know, do a little singing and sing another one and then sing another one and then pray and then pray again and then... But you know, I would rather have a 5-minute meaningful Christian education program than a 1-hour one that was just filled in with a lot of nonsense just to take up the time. You know, it sort of hurts the whole kind of a program that we're trying to do. Now, another question that comes along with that is, well, should they be the persons be included in the regular program, or should they have a special class? I think that's an individual decision that has to be made, and I think to come up with the philosophy that goes into that situation sort of does away with the beauty of that. Now, let me say in my categories up there, if we're talking about persons who can be educated, I think in the main, after they have been initiated properly into church life and who they are, that they can function very well in a group with their normal peers. If the teacher says, now you need to be real careful about not asking this person to read, be sure that the person feels comfortable in that situation. I think that's an essential kind of a thing to do, but they can fit right in. Now, if it's down on the trainable level, you might want to sort of mix that up a little bit. When we're doing singing and group activities, then we might want to have everybody together. But since our important issue is to do some teaching, then what we want to do is to see that that person has a special teacher in order to see that those trainables get their concepts the way they really need to be in and fit down into their heads right. You know, we need to be open about that and not come up with some decision that says, you know, we're going to have everybody in this class. Now, I am a firm believer in mainstreaming. Can you tell that? I believe in mainstreaming. But I am also for good teaching. And if good teaching and mainstreaming come in conflict with each other, I will select good teaching anytime, especially when I am talking or teaching about the most wonderful truth of all, and that is that Jesus loved, died, cares for, gave his life for that person, then I'm not going to let some kind of a philosophy interfere with my teaching. And I think when you come over with that kind of a concept, then people will very readily accept that when they see that that's where the urgency of the issue really is. All right? Christian education programs is something that really needs to get started. Another kind of a program that needs to be going on in the church is pastoral care. Now, down in Melbourne this time last week, I think you were talking about pastoral care, Barbara, so I ought to let you just stand up right now and do that section of the program. But pastoral care is a marvelous thing. Let's start, not necessarily from the top, but the minister needs to be capable of providing care for that person, that intellectually handicapped person. Is that important? Yes, it's important. You know, to interpret in the Christian context who I am and what I am and what I have to offer is an important thing to do, John. That's my responsibility to get that going on in that person. That kind of a pastoral kind of a role is of utmost importance. And for the family of that person, Now, I want to hasten to say, no more pastoral care than any family would have. I think all of us, and I don't know if it's happening in Australia like it's happening in America, we could spend months in the American church talking on pastoral care of the family. Families are falling apart, you know. And I think to come to grips with some of the issues that the wonderful Word of God says about family life and what family is all about needs to be talked about, and it needs to be supported in a ministerial kind of a context. And to say to a family, we really love and care and support. But I want to share a concept that I have shared all over this big country of yours. And that is that the best kind of pastoral care that can be had is not necessarily counseling. That sits down and says, now I want to give you a few little platitudes here. You know, then I can do all my little platitudes. The best kind of help is information. When a set of parents see that they have a handicapped child, they're not interested in platitudes. They're not interested in memory verses. And you know I'm a Christian person, so don't misunderstand. They are interested in what can I do to help my child. And if that information can be shot in as early as possible. And you say, well, now that is the role of the professional community. It is the role of the pastoral community. Because sometimes the person that is in the closest contact in an emotional, intimate kind of a way is that person's pastor. I know a lot of people who will say, have you called the preacher yet? Does he know? And to go in with that kind of information, preachers and church workers, to be able to help is going to relieve families in lots of ways. So those kinds of programs. Now, another kind of a program is the church service. Oh, let me tell you, intellectually handicapped people can profit from church services. And listen, if you listen carefully to them, you profit from their participation in the church service. Now, I'm still among friends. I have read lots of books on how to pray. I have practiced praying. But I learned how to pray from listening to my intellectually handicapped friends. They don't ask God for a lot of stuff they don't need. They ask Him simply and to the point for the day's needs. And the interesting thing is they believe it's going to happen. But always remember, a prayer need that was made known in one of our church services one Sunday morning about a lady whose surgery was due on Thursday of that week, and that they suspected when they opened her up that she would be eaten up with cancer. And we were to pray for that. On the following Sunday, as he was coming in, one of our intellectual handicapped members walked over to the minister and said, and this is the way he talks, he said, how'd that surgery go Thursday, preacher? And the preacher was a little bit startled by that, and he said, which surgery? And he told him which one, and he said, oh, it wasn't cancer. So he took his arm down, and he said, I knew that. And the preacher said, well, how did you know that? He said, that's what I told God to do. Ain't that marvelous? Yes. Now that is a simple, easy, now I don't want to say childlike, but it's that quality that Jesus said, as such is the kingdom of heaven. And they're giving. Oh, they're giving. Giving of themselves, giving of their money. A very favorite one that I couldn't get away without telling this one because they'd fuss at me if they knew I didn't tell it. I love to watch them give. We have a little thing that goes on in our class that we take up money and send it to a needy cause. And one Sunday morning, we sent it when we got $20. And one Sunday morning, we had $25. And we had up front a little thermometer, you know, like you see on fundraising kinds of things. And we pulled that up to $25. And we had a lady in the class who is Down syndrome and a delightful human being. And she's noted by the purses she carries. And this particular one was a tiny little thing on a chain. So So when the minister said, the acting minister said, we have now reached $25, she stood up, put that chain on one end of her finger and swung it around that way and said, whoopee and thank you, Jesus. And sat back down. Now, the interesting part about that morning, we had some rather sophisticated visitors who were there to see our program. And after it was over, I had sort of forgotten what had transpired. And so the man walked out and he said, you know, never in my years of ministry have I seen anything that has moved me like this has. He said, you know, I see these as people. They really care and love God and so forth. And I said, that's right. And we went all the way through this, and I was feeling so good. Then the lady stepped up, and she says, now, I agree with everything my husband has said, but I was just wondering if you ever make any attempt to teach reverence. And I said, and I had forgotten that, and I said, oh, do you think we need to teach reverence? You know, what happened? And then I remembered, whoopee, and thank you, Jesus. So I said, you know, I just sort of thought that through instantly. And I said, no, let me tell you something. You are going by your very false standards. And she smiled and she said, now how do you mean that? And I said, routinely, if you do what you do in our church, when the offering is carried to the front, everybody stands up and sings, praise God from whom all blessings flow. And I said, how many times have you stood up and sung that and didn't mean a word of it? She said, I think I've got your point. I said, these people, in their beauty of their lifestyle, one that I covet, don't have to cut through those things. And I said, I have an idea, too, that if we meant as much as we mean praise God from whom all blessings flow, that God's probably a lot happier with a whippy and thank you, Jesus, than he is with that. And I really mean that. You know, sometimes we just sort of have to move around our little false things of how everything is supposed to be so prim and proper. But we profit from that. That is a built-in kind of dimension. It's an extra dimension to the church experience to hear them participate and know that in all their simplicity that they are really paying their adoration and respects to God. And that cannot be a service they are devoid of. I also want to make one other, before this time gets by, I want to make one other statement in a general sort of way. Do you know, a lot of times we read books, and you're going to read books because there's a lot of them over there, and I felt compelled to do this in the little book that I put together. We talk about, when we teach, the learning characteristics of intellectually handicapped persons, and we list them and discuss them, and somebody like Barbara Lloyd, and I'm sure there are other special education teachers in this room, we know all of those. And we say those as though they are death knells. You know, these people have short concentration spans. Now, that doesn't mean, therefore, they can't be taught. I mean, that's the way we interpret it. But you just take that short attention span and turn that into a tool to teach. Right? Or you say, that concept of perseveration, when the intellectual handicapped person starts doing an act that is long over, it goes past its usefulness, or one of the most common ones you see is rocking back and forth. That's perseveration. But another one could be, you just start their fingers moving that way and they can't get it stopped. Well, that's not a death knell. Turn that into a teaching tool. You know, you learn to switch your activity so that they change out of that activity so quickly. And then that becomes a building stone into their learning process. And we say they have poor communication skills, so they can't learn. Well, I taught a little fellow one time to say 12 words in 1 week. And you know what I did? I couldn't understand the words he was saying, but I got a picture for every word that I wanted to teach him. And I learned what he meant when he said what I wanted him to say. And it was amazing how he, speech therapist, it was amazing how he rolled out of himself, and in a matter of a month he was speaking in sentences. Now those people who are around him could understand, but instead of saying he has poor communication skills, give him good ones. as much as you can. Give him those good kinds of skills, and then that just sort of evolves out of that person, ripples out of that person, all this marvelous information. And I think when we approach learning from that standpoint, capitalizing on the deficits. Is that sort of a Christian concept? Capitalizing on the deficits? I think it ought to be if it's not. But now, the next thing about teaching, and really, it is to learn how people learn. Walked into a classroom one time and saw a creative teacher working. Because over in the corner was a desk, a table it was by itself. And walking around this table was this little boy. And on the table was his work. And I said to her, "What is he doing?" And I said, "He's just going around in circles." And she said, "No, no." She said, "He learns when he moves. And I have learned that movement is the only way that I can get good information into him." And she said, everybody else has understood that in the class. And sure enough, all the little kids were over there doing their learning. But it's also interesting to me that some of them had headphones on and they were listening because that's the way they learn best. Some of them were looking at big picture books, learning the same lesson that he was learning to read. And that creative teacher had opened up every channel to get into learning. You see what I'm saying? And those of you, and I'm seeing so many heads going up and down like that I know you know what I'm talking about. Those of you who work with intellectual handicapped people, persons, you almost pick that up 2 or 3 weeks into your being with them. You just know what it is that's open to them. I had to evaluate a little fellow one time in an educational setting, and the reason that we got to evaluate him was that somebody had requested, you know, we can't get anywhere with this child because we do not know how it is that he is communicating with his environment. So he walked into the room where I was, and I felt sort of embarrassed because I had to keep him an hour, but I answered my question 1 minute into it. When he walked into my room, he would go on everything like this. You know, touch everything that he went by. So I just sort of walked over to my desk and wrote my report. I said, when teaching this child, accent all kinds of tactile information. You know, use sandpaper, pictures, letters, that kind of thing. And they started doing that, you know, giving him opportunity to touch. And then after we had gotten that report off and we got a good positive report back at the end of 6 weeks that period of time he'd really learned and gained some information, we got an older report on him that the teacher, his previous teacher, had written. And one of her goals was to teach him not to touch everything. have you got my point? Now when... whatever channel it is, are channels that are still open. You need to accent that to really use that as a opening to get into the mind that is having to function by way of a brain that is not taking all that information in. And Christians, if you take those two concepts, that is, accenting the negative learning concepts that they have going against them, and turn them into something for them, and then opening up whatever channel it is and using that channel as often as possible. Now, that is one of the reasons that in a Christian education session, that if you use as many different types of presentation as possible, something they can look at, something they can hear, something they can taste. I started to say taste. Something they can taste, something they can smell, something they can touch. You know, the more kinds of activities going on, the chances of their learning quickly are going to be greatly heightened. But just to go in and say, well, we're going to use Flannelgraph today. What if there's a kid in there that doesn't learn by seeing? You know, you need to use all sorts of kinds of things. Now, one of the things that I would like to stress to you, too, is to always let them participate just as much as possible in the process. All right, now, I want to walk over here and be sure that I have said everything that I wrote down on my paper to say before we open that up. Now, are there areas that you would like for me to talk about before I ask you to give any questions to me? You see, I hope what I have done in talking about these things is to give you a feeling about the challenge to the church, dealing with attitudes, preparing the congregation, and developing a philosophy. Think you got enough to do that on? Now, is there anything that anybody wants to talk to me about? how would you do this? Or is there something that I haven't discussed there? Think about materials.
Came with Sunday school. It's a Sunday school for children up to 16. We have a boy who, for quite a big part of the Sunday school, simply makes a noise. Now, we've attempted to turn him off. Now, should we be using that to turn him on? Or how can we get to him?
Okay, now Jim, one of the problems in answering that kind of question is not knowing why the child does that, but generally speaking, I'm not responding to that specifically, but generally speaking, to use that into a meaningful sort of a way to use it as a teaching tool. I know the only sound that that we had a girl who could make one time was that and we used her in a rhythm band activity. And her role was not to go but she had to go And you know, it was amazing. It didn't take very long for her to develop that, and interestingly enough, did a little speaking from that. But now, if it's just a natural sort of thing, as this was, it was her way of communicating. If it is an attention-getting device, it's best to discourage it. And most of the time, that can be discouraged by just quietly saying no. Mr. Smith, goodness, that's the first time I have called him Mr. Smith in all this time. Ed, oh, he won't know what his title ought to be, and I told him His Eminence. Oh, I bet. But Ed and I visited a program, and they had a marvelous teacher in the group. I'm not even sure she was a teacher, but some kind of a person dealing with these youngsters. And she had the most marvelous use of her finger. Did you notice that, Ed? She just put her finger to her lips, and they knew what she was supposed to do. And if that didn't happen, she could be a little bit more forceful, you know, to indicate that. So I think it, Jim, really depends in a general sort of way if it is something that is being done to try to communicate as opposed to attract attention. Use it if it's to communicate. Ignore it. Let it drop out if it's to get attention. Any other questions? If you have one, give us just a minute to get the, just a minute. We need to get the mic to you. Is how do you deal with a child with autistic-like tendencies and other traits as well? Do you imply in that there's a lot of disruptive behavior? Have you tried to teach this person in a regular classroom? I mean, in or just yes. Okay. Yes. 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 I don't want to have any kind of a look on my face that, you know, as you well know, autism is a very difficult kind of a situation to deal with, because basic to the autistic diagnosis is lack of involvement with their environment. And until there is something that is achieved that lets that person move out of that self-centered kind of a world to touch that environment, it is a very, very difficult process. And no, I do not have any kind of recommendations. As a matter of fact, the times that I have seen good things happen have happened, and I had no idea what caused that to happen. And I shared yesterday when we visited the Autistic Association here in town, and they showed us through their very fine facility with the therapy director. We have a little boy who comes to our program who's autistic, and his entrance into the world was through my watch. Now, I did not say to him, watch. I had tried for months, because I like to be in touch with all the youngsters who come to the center. And when I would see him in the hallway, I would talk to him and go into the therapy room and chat with him. And one day he just laid his hand over on my watch and said, watch. And do you know that I can greet him now that he has become somewhat more verbal? His behavior is under some better control. I can walk up to him, and even if my coat is down over my watch, when he sees me, he says, watch, Pearson. You know, and that's his, and his mother says when he refers to me at home, it's always preceded by watch. You know, he, and there was something about my watch that was just caught him, and he moved in. But now I'm illustrating that to say that there are other people in his environment that have never been able to get into him, you know. And mine's just a very easy, sweet, kind, you know. And sometimes he has nothing to do with me. You know, he doesn't want to bother me. And sometimes you feel that you're making progress and it got in, and then the next time you go back, I love your smile and you're shaking your head. And I really wish, and I only hope for this population in our society, that the great emphasis that's being placed on it now, now that we've sort of defined what it is and we know what we're dealing with, I hope in a few years the massive research that's going on will open up some avenues for those persons. As a matter of fact, I pray that that happens.
Therapy Center, and I'm an activity officer, and listening to you today, I was thinking of the education, Christian education in there. And we've got a cross-section where you get a number out of residentials that have very good Christian education with their own Sunday school and within the home. And then we've got others that are very anti-everything. Have you got any hints for that within a program, within an activity therapy center?
Yes. And I always like to respond to that one because for some reason I think that that is also a place that Christian influence can really be felt. I never suggest that that there be any kind of overt kinds of activities to get that done. But I think that that is when you as a Christian person have the best opportunity to try to use influence for good to get all of that accomplished. You know, and I think that's an exciting kind of an opportunity. But then if there were ever a time that you could, through your own congregation where you serve, or where you serve through, to go back to my first point from this morning, if you could open up the services to those people and you could bring them in and teach them there. Because do you have a regulation in your activity therapy center that you cannot have religious kind of services? Okay. Let me tell you what I would do. I would try, you know, in a 5 or 10 minute kind of a situation, to have a daily good moral thought based on the scriptures. Yes, I wouldn't even hesitate to do that. As a matter of fact, I have heard several times since I have been here from persons in your position that they had done that. They had started little Bible studies with them, simple things on their level. That they can really appreciate and understand. So yes, I would encourage you to start a simplified Bible study. You know, you might call it the verse of the day, and then talk about that and do a flannel graph story or some kind of a picture to remind them about it. And yes, I think that'd be a marvelous thing, especially if it's done under the concept of the church. And I need to tell you that one of the things that I've had to sort of change my way of thinking about when I see you, your programs here. You know, the church and the government work closely together here in terms of funding. Well, in the state, they're poles apart. You know, if it's a church program, you can very readily know that there's no government money in it because the church and the state are poles apart. So that was the reference that I was making. So, no, I would encourage you to think about doing a little Bible verse of the day kind of a concept because I think it would work. And I'm not too sure that in that services that you would offer to them, Ed, that having a guide for those kinds of things would be extremely helpful since you've got that kind of clustering of intellectual handicapped persons.
A number of them are involved in Crossroads, as much as they're involved in the church.
That's right. Good. But I would encourage you to do something. Now, we've got one, Robin.
I'm going on a bit further to adult stage, not particularly with intellectually handicapped, but a problem that I've encountered from friends of mine that two handicapped, severely handicapped people want to marry and they want to go and see a minister, and there's all sorts of pressure put on them and saying, oh, you don't need to worry about marriage, and you don't, they sort of downplay the sexual role and they sort of get horrified that they can relate to each other in a physical way, in sort of a way of relating to each other. And I'm just wondering, how can the church encourage the couples to relate to each other in the sense, the spiritual sense, and also particularly to the family or the community, where they get so uptight about two physically handicapped people marrying, wanting to marry?
Okay, now I want to I want to say some things that that I can speak more about in America than I can in Australia, so I want you to know that that's my framework. Robin, one of the concepts that is so wrong in what you have related to me, now not that you've related the concept wrong, because I think you have done it, but in the situation that you have described, one of the best kinds of helpful situations is that it be a two-way kind of a street. And I take no kind of pleasure in the concept that we people who know all the answers are going to tell everybody else what to do, you know, if you can or cannot get married. Do you see what's wrong with that? I think what we really need to do is to provide realistic information, you know. And really, you know, you see what the future is, what being married is all about. And if two persons who just happen to have handicaps want to be married, I think we just ought to handle that like we handle everything else. You know, it's done in a very prayerful, now you're asking me in the context of the church, prayerful, systematic kind of a counseling way where people make those decisions. Now, there is a time that I think in the case of very severe, well, moderate to severe mental retardation, then I think that the counseling needs to be a little bit sturdier. Because, you see, we get into the responsibility level of providing for youngsters, if that's the case, or managing daily affairs, if that's the case. But at the same time, I just think that it needs to be handled that way. Now, you understand my concept there. Natural as possible. But now the other thing that I want to say that I have no time or no patience with, and if this sounds old-fashioned or whatever it is, we have had movements in America to encourage persons to be promiscuous. And I tell you, you know, I believe that thou shalt not commit adultery is as valid today as it was, you know, ever how many years ago that was done, put into existence. And I think the church cannot let go with that beautiful concept that encourages the beauty of family life. So I think in that case, if it's sexuality that people are really dealing with and think that can operate outside of the context of marriage, and I think there are a lot of people who feel that way, then I think the church is beholden in its counseling programs to talk about avenues and ways to express those feelings of sexuality that are in keeping with the teachings of the church. But now, to summarize what I've said to you, I know marriages of persons who are handicapped that are marvelous marriages, you know, and for us able-bodied persons to superimpose on everybody our opinions I just don't agree with that. You know, I think it's here's my basic answer. I think it is an individual matter that two people need to come to grips with, the same way I discussed that with my wife when we got married. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yes, one couple. The wife is an enabler, and the one person I am thinking of has got muscular dystrophy. Is a very active person, and there's pressures in that marriage because the situation, he's heavily involved with many activities, and there's pressures because he's so heavily involved, there's no life in the home,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of can't relate to each other, and what's happening is trouble in that marriage. They can't sort of relate. Do you relate to the person, and you get one side of the story, but I want to outdistance myself, not get involved in the situation, because I don't think I can handle it. But how can you tell your friend who's handicapped, take it easy, you're doing too much, and you'll find that you won't have marriage at the time's end, and how can I get this through?
I understand what you're saying, but Robin, that problem is... It's not exclusive to a marriage of handicapped persons. I think whichever it is, man, male or female, in the case, I think that person needs to recognize that there is a responsibility for family life. And he just needs to stress that you know, when I told the minister that I would stick with Norma for better, for worse, and all those kinds of things, I just think that has to be there. But you know, I really think that one of the things that we do not do, now you didn't invite me over here to talk about family life, now I'll throw a little thing in for family life here, Ed. Do you know that a big part of my ministry is my role as husband and father? And I've got to, you know, I have got to do that. It's not just a matter of taking time to do it. There's nobody else that I can to leave that to. I can't substitute that. You know, I've got to do that myself. You know, we could get somebody else to run the rehabilitation center and somebody else to do the teaching and somebody else to do the consulting. But you can't get somebody else to take your role as husband and father. And I think that's sort of what your friend needs to be told, that he's got to program, if you will, into his life time in the home. And marriage counselor kinds of people would I'm sure say that more and more, Robin. So I really think that it's not just, I don't think being a handicapped person or one part of the marriage being handicapped would attribute to that. I just think that's a sort of a normal kind of thing.
Roman had said in the past 3 or 4 years we have seen in our area many marriages of handicapped people, and out of the marriages at one time or another I would say about 95% of these marriages have broke up. And I know it's not only handicapped people, but to me, that are really high percentage within handicapped people. And I feel so strongly. Can't win that they're not getting a social worker can't help them. That only one person that can help them. And that is important. And I just feel that they are really important in their counseling before they're married. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I appreciate that. But again, I think that kind of, I think that counseling needs to be in any kind of situation. I have no patience with this contemporary feeling that if it doesn't work out well, we can get a divorce. That just bothers me. So I appreciate your extra. That's a beautiful word. Yeah. Unfortunately. All right. Is lunch ready? Now, listen, I need to let me say one half of a word. I really have enjoyed these 2 hours together. It's been a marvelous time, and I want you to know that when I am back in America, I've always had feelings about where Australia is. You know, wow, you know, halfway around the other side of the world. But that's no longer going to be so, because Australia is going to be as close as my heart, because it is full of all the wonderful and marvelous friendships that I have established since I have been here. And when I think about this beautiful place, it won't be far away, because I know people like you who live here, and I'll think about you, and you'll be next door. And I appreciate that good feeling very, very much.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Now, there are a few announcements. One that Jim will be leaving us fairly early after lunchtime, but he is going to have here on our carousel the story of his own facility over in Knoxville. And I think perhaps if you'd, in the free time that is there, you may have arranged other things, and that's okay, but that's where, when that set of photos will be shown. Now, tomorrow morning, the service at St Andrews in Ann Street is open to the special service where we'll focus on access for persons with disabilities, and Jim will be the special preacher. People from the Crossroads movement will be part of that service, and we are hopeful that even now, if you're thinking of people that may like to be there, we'd like you to let them know about that. As a consultation group, it's the intention that that's where we move tomorrow morning, and lunch will be provided by the St Andrews Fellowship, and they're expecting to cater for up to 100 people. So if you did invite a friend or two extra, don't be too embarrassed. Are there any questions on that, Ruth?
Yes, I just want to know, we've come down, we need a lift up to the church.
Good. Well, yes, I think that we'll have to... I wonder if people who need transport, if they will let Shirley know. If she can assemble all the needs, then we can work that out. Okay? Now, the tapes that are coming out... I just draw attention, you will have a number on the bottom of that tape. There will also be the number on the tape itself. But I think it's worth taking it out and putting the number on the card that's inside, because that'll be very easily moved off. It's just a little thing. Now, literature, we have there the takeaway literature and the literature that you can order. Now, I'm wondering if Lynn and Laurie might just be there from time to time. And there's an order sheet where, though the Jim's book is available right now at $2.50, but there's very few other books that are available other than for ordering. So we suggest you do not give your money, that if it's the book you want or books you want, we take those orders and then we send that book when we get it with the account. We have got those... Oh, please. Yeah, if you've taken any book, would you please make sure that they're there at all times? Because it's important that we expose those books to as many people as possible for this short time. And then if it's a particular book that you're waiting on while we're ordering it, well, very likely from our office we can handle that. You'll notice that the extension education, the four tapes on... Ministry with Handicapped People is available at $20, and we have found a tremendous response to that, and people are affirming that it is a very good set. So please look at that, and it may be that you as a person or the group that you're representing may like to take that. Payment for weekend, particularly Lynn, and Lynn and Laurie will be there, but Lynn would like to receive any monies. And if you have question about the fact that you weren't here for all the time, says, well, you do your deal with her. And she'll give you the receipt. Now, are there any questions before we leave for lunch? Yes, Colin? Sorry, Gordon? Just a minute, Gordon. This isn't being needed to be recorded, is it?
No, no.
It's just giving me a...
Just a point. Do we need to pay separately for accommodation and separately for books and separately for tapes, for example, or can it all be in the one payment, or just what is your wish in that way?
Oh, thanks, Gordon. On the tapes, just have we got clarification on that, Shirley? Do we pay our money all to Des and Dorothy? And all the rest could be in one cheque. Crossroads Queensland and our accounting system will fix that up.
There will definitely be seven tapes in the full set.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. That's right, isn't it, Dorothy? It's coming. Yes, it's coming through.
Thank you.
Yes, Alan.
If I'd like to say, I would say I'm speaking on behalf of everybody here. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for Crossroads, the committee that organised for Jim and his family to be able to be here. Australia-wide, we've benefited, and
tremendous. Thank you very much, Alamine.
Alamine, I appreciate that so much, but I want to say something publicly. I don't know how many of you know Alamine Gray and her family who run the Edgar Courts in town, but I am sure that in the history of that place, nobody has received the services that Jim, Norma, Rebecca, Rachel, and Erica Pearson have. You know, it's not even, I'm smiling, but it's not a joke. She takes us to the airport. She takes us to the bank. She takes us to the...
Gold Coast.
Yes. I'll never forgive her for that.
You should have seen in the night that I got off the phone and said, your wife and children are at the Gold Coast. He went, boom.
You know, I thought they were sitting there wringing their hands wanting me to come home. But no, I tell you, it has been, I have never seen such hospitality. And I got a tear in my eye when we flew up to Townsville. And Alamine took us to the airport to meet the plane. And when we had been seated on the plane, as a matter of fact, when she had gotten us there, she could easily have driven back home. But when the plane backed around and started its journey out for the takeoff, Alamine and her son were standing there waving us off. And Alamine, nobody will feel as warm to us as you do. As a matter of fact, if there's some way we can get you in to take you home with us to keep taking care of us, we'll do that. She's a marvelous Christian lady, and that's
reflected. And we'd affirm that.